I have a little surprise for you, Corey. There's a link in the show notes if you want to go ahead and open that.
Okie dokie. Let's see what this surprise is.
And then you let me know what you see there.
I see an iPhone screen.
Yeah.
With the date on it, on the top of it. A beautiful background. And then it says capture, mind maps, notes, community, podcast, writing, message, mindfulness, and prayer.
Yeah. So that is my new iPhone home screen. And what's different about this for people who are listening to this audio podcast?
I have no idea. I mean, like, what's different about this? Can you interact with that? Like, that's my first thing I'm gonna yeah. Like, can I click yeah. on capture? Or can I click on
my
note?
So this is my new iPhone home screen, and there are no icons and there is no dock, and I love it.
Okay, so how are you doing it?
Yeah, so I'm using an app called Blank, I believe is the name, and it essentially lets you create these widgets, which then you can put on your home screen. So in the app, you can choose, these are the things that I want to set up, and that's kind of like the launcher. That's the middle part. So you can rename these. So capture is actually drafts. Mind maps is MindNode. Notes is Obsidian. Community is Circle. Podcast is Overcast. Writing is actually a web app that I had saved to my phone. I use Typefully to post to Twitter, Mastodon, and LinkedIn, although not very consistently. So that's like the next thing on my creative checklist, is to start writing more consistently. That allows me to post without having to go in and look at what is there. Then messages is just messages. Mindfulness is this mindfulness meditation app that I found called Do Nothing, where you literally just start a timer and then do nothing.
Wow.
And
that
then
sounds
it,
cool.
It builds the metric, is they call it the chillometer at the end. And this is something that I really am trying to get into a habit of doing consistently again. Prayer is the Echo app. And what's cool about this is that you can actually use it to just open the app. So they have, like, you can choose from the list. These are the apps that we know about, and you can create a shortcut to that app just by selecting from the list. Some apps aren't on their list yet, so you can use either the URL scheme if you know it, or you can use a shortcut. So some of these are shortcuts that just open an app. I don't think I have any like custom URL schemes, but you could do something like that as well. So that's like the middle widget. And then the top widget, you can just do a couple of things there. You can put the date, you can put the actual day of the week, you can put the weather, you can put like a 5-day forecast, or you can leave it blank. And then what you do is you download these wallpapers that they have several of them on their website, both light and dark mode. You can download those, put them as the background on your phone, and then you have to take a screenshot of that background. So you use that wallpaper, but then in the app itself, there's a button and it says import from this image. And it basically just like puts the appropriate slice of that in the background of the widgets. So it looks like they're just floating there and there's no colored background. And then essentially the dock is there. It just doesn't have any icons in it. And the bottom of the wallpaper is the exact same color as the dock. So you can't actually see it.
That is crazy. And I realized where I made the mistake in my thinking. I thought this was your lock screen. This
No.
is your lock screen. This is your home screen. So this
is
like
my home screen. Yes.
Cause I'm sitting here thinking through this and I'm like, okay, lock screen. Like I don't know. Like, is this that interesting? And I was like, oh, but it's his home screen.
Yep.
It's his home screen. I was like, this is amazing. So I might actually be stealing almost all of this, except for what you actually have on the screen, the content of the screen. I might actually be making my own, because that sounds perfect.
Yeah. So the whole idea behind this is really just to force yourself down some specific intentionality paths whenever you reach for your phone. And without having any sort of icons on here, that really just kind of creases the effect. You know, it sounds stupid, but you open up your iPhone, and even if you don't do anything with those icons that are on the front, it's like, ooh, shiny, you know, because it's all colorful. Yeah. So,
and the logos and the icons are made to do that, aren't they? Right? Like
they're made to
you and attract you to that thing. This is funny because I posted in the in your community, in the faith-based productivity community, the other day about like Brick, which basically bricks your phone
in
certain times. And then I've looked at Light Phone. I've looked at, you know, some of these other ways to reduce the functionality of your smartphone. This seems like a really cool way to do that, but in a customized way. I like that. I like that a lot.
This is inspired by the Light Phone. We actually have one of those for my oldest son. And I like it a lot. I have toyed with the idea of getting one myself. I think I probably will at some point in the near future. The thing that is keeping me on the iPhone, honestly, is just the mind maps. Like, I could move the podcast over. I could move the directions over. I really don't care about text messaging anyways. But the way that I take book notes, there's no alternative for that on the Light Phone. But this is like as close as you can get without actually having the Light Phone.
Yeah.
There's one other thing you could do. I have an accessibility shortcut set up. So if you hit the home button on the side three times, it turns your phone into grayscale mode. So that makes it even less appealing.
But yeah, you really doubled down on that.
Yeah. So I like this a lot, and it's working for me. Now, obviously, like, you can do other things besides this. You can do focus modes, and you can set up, you know, intentional home screens. And I've done all that kind of stuff in the past, but this is like that to the next level. And I gotta admit, I really like it. So I will actually be writing about this in the upcoming newsletter. It'll already be out by the time people hear this. So there will be a link to the actual newsletter where you can go read about this in the show notes, because I use ConvertKit for those. And so you get like the public feed or whatever. So you can link to specific newsletters if people want to see this for themselves. But I thought you might appreciate this and wanted to share it with you.
I'm very much going to appreciate this. And that will be another rabbit hole that I'll have to figure out when I'm going to dive down into that one. So that sounds fun.
Nice.
No, thanks for sharing that.
Yep. All right. And then we've got a couple of follow-up items. Now, you had mentioned the post in the faith-based productivity community. That was actually one of my action items, was setting up the new community, or at least having a landing page that people could go to sign up for when it's going to be available. So I got that done by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah, so there'll be a link in the show notes for that as well. But the plan is, we're going on vacation. We're recording this a little bit early. And then when we come back at the end of February, I am wanting to have that active. And everything basically from the Faith-Based Productivity community and the Obsidian University community is going to be brought there. It's going to take me a little while to bring over all of the courses and things. But I want to have one place for all that, and then also all of my book notes and things will be there as well. So I don't have any specific details to share yet about signing up, but there is a page where you can go get a notification when it's ready.
Nice. I think that'll be very, very valuable for folks as you make this transition. So that's good.
Awesome. The other action item I had was try Cornell Notes in Obsidian. And I followed your advice and I watched some videos on Cornell Notes. GoodNotes actually had a pretty good resource for what are Cornell Notes. And I have the plugin, CSS snippet, whatever, installed. And I'm not using it a ton, but I do think that there are some specific places where this could be useful. I guess what I discovered was that when I am working with notes in Obsidian, a lot of times I don't have the need for these Cornell Notes, because a lot of the ideas and things will come from the mind maps, from the books that we read, and then I bring those in and I break those apart into atomic notes, but there's no need for additional Cornell Notes there. Where the Cornell Notes could be useful, I think, in the future is as I'm going through and I'm developing the maps of content, or the MOCs, where it's kind of like my workbench where I'm working through some ideas. I will occasionally just like bring in links to other notes and add opinion notes, and this is what I think. And I've been using callouts for a lot of those opinion notes, but I think there could be some opportunity to add some additional context via these, like, I'm calling them Cornell Notes, but they're basically just footnotes that appear on the side in Obsidian.
Yeah. Yeah. I think where I would see this being the most effective for me in the way I work, which I know you don't consume a lot, but it's like if I'm watching a YouTube video to try to learn something, I think a Cornell note in Obsidian would make complete sense there.
True.
You know, seeing that and then translating that into something. What I'm curious with you, have you done a video or have you written about it anywhere about how you make your atomic notes, or is that part of one of your courses or part of one of your things? Because this is where my system always falls down. It's like, oh, I'm thinking about, I just took these notes on this book, or I just processed through this book, and now I need to think about what do I do with this, and it's that next step. So,
yeah,
what's your guidance for me there?
I do have a video that I've done on that. I'm not sure if it speaks directly to the specific thing that you're talking about, but it does kind of talk about the value of the atomic notes. So I'll put a link to that YouTube video in the show notes for people. But I think atomic notes are tricky because you kind of have to figure out your own level of atomicity. It's a word I just made up.
I'm pretty sure that's not a word. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not a word.
Like, you got to figure out when to break things apart, and it's kind of just trial and error. You want to go into it thinking, what are the smallest component pieces that will be useful? And so the example I talk about in the cohorts is when I came into Obsidian, I wanted to build my own cross-reference library from sermon notes that I had taken, and I had kind of seen that in action in other like Bible software like Logos or Accordance. So I'm going to use the individual verses as the smallest atomic piece because that's going to be the link between these different things. Side note, isn't it crazy that you can basically replicate the functionality of those $1,000 software programs inside of a free app?
Oh man. they really are developing wizards, aren't they? I mean, the way they've given that thing the ability to do essentially what you want with it. It's really cool. And then all the community too.
Yep. Absolutely. So I don't know if I have any specific advice for you other than maybe go watch that video, wrap your head around like how you would use those atomic notes, and then that will probably spur some ideas when you are in your green hat thinking mode, as we'll talk about
right.
in a little bit.
That's right. Okay, so my follow-up item was to read a physical book and annotate it, which I did that this time. So I actually have the paper version of the book sitting right beside me. What I'll tell you is I liked that experience. I very much enjoyed that experience, except for the fact that like I felt like I needed a second notebook to write down. I write down a lot, right? So I think the difference between you and I is I write down a lot more than you do when I'm going through this book. So I felt like I needed a second book, and I was annoyed with the second notebook. So I have to figure out a better system for that. Like, is it note cards per chapter? Is it something, you know, if I'm going to read a physical book, how do I still collect all the things that I want, but not have to carry around the second piece of material? I didn't like doing that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know how you're going to get around that.
I know. I don't either. I haven't figured it out yet. So I'm kind of, so dear listener, if you haven't figured this out, I'm figuring out my note system. So I've tried mind maps. I've tried to put these notes into Notion and then highlight different things out of there. I've now done a physical copy of the book with actually handwritten notes in a paper notebook. And what I'll tell you is that the thing I've learned from all of this, which is probably the most valuable reason for doing this, is I'm a write more, summarize again kind of guy. That is how my brain needs to process through things in order to be able to think about it across boundaries and then be able to talk about it and be able to like actually use it, which I probably could have told you this from doing my PhD, that's how I was. Because I mean, I created, do you remember VoodooPad? Do you remember the software VoodooPad?
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah, so before all of the stuff that we have now that'll link things, VoodooPad was a very, very simple, very, very good way to basically make your own wiki. And I did that with a lot of the work that fed into my dissertation. Is I made my own wiki about connecting different ideas and different thoughts. So I probably could have told you that I was a summary kind of guy before, but I'm confirming that right now as we read these books. So, yeah. So if you think of a good idea, or if anybody thinks of a good idea about how I could take the notes and also have the physical copy of the book together at the same time, I would even be willing. I'm not sold on physical books yet, So I would even be willing to have my, yeah, I'd be willing to have my digital book, but then I think the handwritten notes is very, very valuable for me. I really think that is. And it almost makes me wonder, I'm not going to go buy one, but what's the big Android tablet that like flips open, or the Android phone that flips open? Is it the Z Flip? No, I don't know.
I don't know. I do have an Android, actually two Android devices. They are E-Ink. There's an E-Ink tablet, the Onyx Books, and then I got the Onyx Palma, the like phone size e-reader. But I don't think that's what you're talking about. You're talking about things where you can have two screens essentially side by side.
Essentially,
right?
If I could have the one screen be the book on the left and then the right-hand side of the screen be my pen that I can take notes on, I actually think that's my ideal setup. But I'm not willing to go to Android because everything else I have works so well and is all Apple stuff. So
what if you used like the Kindle app or Apple Books in split screen on an iPad, and then on the other side you had like GoodNotes?
I can try that. My limitation right now, and the reason why that doesn't resonate with me right now, is I have the largest iPad. So for that to hold that, is it's too bulky, but that works really well for my teaching. Sure. So it's like, I wonder if I would get an iPad mini, is that like the right size, or is the text too small in the book? And then do I have enough space to write? Like I bet you if I could do that in the iPad mini, that'd be very compelling. I think very compelling.
I have an iPad mini. I like it a lot, but I feel like if you put stuff in split screen and then tried to use one side as a notebook, it's probably a little too small.
Yeah, okay. Well, like I told you, I told Mike before we started recording, I'm going to go try out the Vision Pro today. I have a demo, and while I'm there, I'll look at the iPad mini and I'll hold it in my hand and say, do I think I could do this? And, you know, it's probably not worth the money, but at the same time, it'd be fun to try.
Yeah, it hasn't been updated in a long time, so don't buy one yet, but maybe when they update it.
Yeah, what's the website that tells you how long it's been since they've updated something?
Ooh, I think it's Mac Rumors. I can't remember, but they had like the buyer's guide. And I know what you're talking about. It's like green is like, go ahead and buy now. Gray is like neutral. You know, it's the middle of product cycle. And then there's the red, like, don't buy this. Yes. An update is imminent.
It hasn't been updated in 287 days. Like, please don't. Please. Or yeah. You know, 700 days or whatever it was. So.
Cool.
All righty. You want to talk about a book?
Let's do it. So today's book is Six Thinking Hats by Edward de Bono, who I had never heard about before. But after reading this, it sounds like he's a pretty big thinker in the business world, and I probably should have at some point.
Well, what got me there was when he says in one part of the book, I invented this type of thinking in 1967. And
yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. I guess you are a big kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and then he mentions very casually a couple other books that he has written, which sound fascinating, to be honest. So this is sort of like an introduction to this concept of these six thinking hats, but it sounds like there's even a whole company and training materials and probably certified coaches and all that kind of stuff around actually implementing this. And at the very end of the book, they actually have someone you can write to get more information on those training resources. So that kind of dates, I think, how old this material is. I know I have the international bestseller, which is revised and updated. Is that the version that you got?
That is the version I got.
Okay, because I know you had sent me a link at one point, and you're like, is this the right one? Because the covers are very, very different. Yeah. We're reading the one that has like the hand-drawn six-colored top hats on the front.
Yeah, and the copyright on the one we're reading is 1999. That's the latest copyright on the one we're reading.
Cool. It's broken down into sections based on the hat colors. So there's an introduction, which has three chapters, talks about the general approach. And then there's a section on the white hat, a section on the red hat, a section on the black hat, a section on the yellow hat, a section on the green hat, a section on the black hat.
Last one was blue hat.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Did I say black again?
Yeah, you said black again.
Whoops. I have it written down as blue in my mind map. Guess I need more coffee? I don't know.
Well, the funny thing is when I was writing my notes on this, I did BHT for black hat thinking, and then I did BHT for blue hat thinking, and I didn't realize I did that until I went through my summary. I was like, huh, I didn't realize I gave it the same acronym.
So I like the structure of this book. I do have to ask you a question. Can you, because I see you have the book in your hands, can you turn to page 169 for me and tell me what chapter number you have there?
I noticed it too. Yep, they're wrong.
Okay.
So it should be 42. 169 should be 42. And then what is it? 170 should be 43.
Yes, yeah, but that is also chapter 42 again.
Yeah, it's a typo. I noticed that too. I was like, that actually usually doesn't happen, especially in chapter titles. You know, that's a...
Especially in like big businessy books.
Yeah.
So that was kind of weird, but...
I want to double down with you though on the fact that his other books sound really interesting as well. And I had this little mini thought of like, do we go down the De Bono rabbit hole, right? Where like the next 3 weeks, and I was like, man, we probably shouldn't do that. But at the same time, I think I could, right? Like Lateral Thinking is one of the books. Teach Your Child How to Think is another one. Yes. Well, what was the other one? Yes, Something, No.
Oh, man, I don't remember. I didn't write those down.
It sounded really interesting too. So I agreed with you on that aspect.
Yeah. So this, I think is probably the thing that he is most well known for based on how it was positioned and like go get more training at the end, but maybe not because he did invent that term lateral thinking in 1967. And that is the name of another book. And there's a lot of other, you're right, rabbit holes that could be gone down as after using this as the springboard here. But I really like the premise of this book, which is that there's these six different types of hats that you can wear, and you have to put them on at different times, and it kind of changes your focus. And that is what allows you to have more effective meetings, think more completely about things, get better ideas, make better decisions, yada, yada, yada. So I think for the outline here, probably makes sense to talk about the intro because that's kind of the format. And then there's 42 plus one chapters and a conclusion. But we won't tackle it by chapter. We'll tackle it by the groupings of the colored hats probably.
That's the same way I was thinking about doing it. So that's great.
Cool. All right. Well, let's do the introduction here first. So the introduction has three chapters. The first one is an introduction, and he's trying to juxtapose traditional thinking, which is arguing until one side is proved right, with this idea of parallel thinking, where both views are put down in parallel. And then the way to embrace that parallel thinking is to wear these different hats. So there's six different directions of thinking that are represented by these hats. White, which is neutral and objective, it's concerned with facts and figures. The red hat is the emotional view, and the color kind of suggests anger. Black hat is like somber and serious, cautious and careful, points out the weaknesses of an idea. The yellow hat is sunny and positive, optimistic, covers hope and positive thinking. The green hat is abundant, fertile growth, indicates creativity and new ideas. And then the blue hat is kind of at another level above this, cool color of the sky. It's above everything else. It's concerned with control and the organization of the thinking process. So this is more about thinking about thinking, kind of meta. And there are different pairs of these that you can use in conjunction with one another, which I thought was interesting. So like white and red, black and yellow, green and blue. But really, the whole idea is that let's say you're in a meeting with your team. And instead of just like naturally responding in a way that seems appropriate, the facilitator can say, okay, that's enough black hat thinking. Now we need to switch into yellow hat thinking. Give me some reasons why this idea might be a good one. And so you can kind of direct the thinking paths there and explore things more completely, which I can tell you, having been in enough team meetings that have gone off the rails because someone just gets stuck in one of these modes, this is brilliant. And I wish I had come across this a lot sooner.
I could not agree more in terms of the fact that just simplifying it down to these six hats and then basically giving everybody a common ground to talk on around that hat and giving some control or some direction of the meeting. I mean, it's just a really interesting concept. And whether you agree with all the hats and whether you agree with the way he breaks down all the hats or whatever that is, the general idea was, revolutionary sounds like too strong of a word, but I mean, it really like kind of like shocked me. I was like, wow, this is actually a really clever way to think about running a meeting, running an organization, trying to make a decision. One of the things I want to drive home here in the intro section is this idea of we're trying to set a direction mm-hmm. for decision making, right? Like, so he calls out the fact that the six hats in themselves, really, who cares? But what we're trying to do is we're trying to use those as a tool to set a direction. And then what he's going to do later on in the book, and as he works through the book, he's going to start talking about it as a map. And I loved when he started talking about it as a map, because that made so much sense to me. Is like, all right, the six hats allow us to develop the different components of the map. And then once we've developed the map, he says at one in here, the rest of it just unfolds, right? Like the decision just unfolds once we've developed the map. And I thought the way he frames the whole thing is just really, really clever.
I love the analogy of the map as well. There were a couple analogies in here that I thought were really great. And it's kind of interesting. So like the map one resonates with me because of the Great Mental Models by Shane Parrish and Rhianna Bobbin, where that's where I first encountered the mental model of the map is not the territory. And I think that's a really powerful idea. I talk about that in my practical PKM cohort. So I literally just harped on that whole thing about you have to embrace the role of the cartographer and you get to choose what should be on this map. And essentially, like what he's talking about here is the same sort of process with the people in a group. And then you got to chart your way forward based on the information that you decided should be on there. There's another one in here about ideas as like plants and having like a greenhouse and developing them. And that's like the basis of the creativity flywheel thing that I taught in the practical PKM cohort. And it's used in a little bit of a different context, but a lot of the same perspective, same ideas are there. So in some ways, selfishly, I liked it as validation for some of this stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Made sense to me, and I've been teaching other people, and like they seem to like it. But then it's like, oh, well, actually, here's someone else who thinks about it that way. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'll call out a couple other things that I got out of this intro. Is this came from him working with actual clients and trying to support them in a consulting effort. So on the very back of the book, he's worked with IBM, Exxon, DuPont, Prudential, Procter & Gamble, General Foods, Shell, right, and all these other companies, you know, and basically calls out and he says, hey, this came from me working with these people. And he throws out some stats or some like, look how successful this is. And that's less relevant, but it comes from practice, which I like that idea. I like that there's a theory behind it and you can tell that there's a theory of lateral thinking behind it, which is a different book. This is the, look how this has worked in practice. I really like that. And then he drives home this idea of argument, which we're going to get to when we get to Black Hat. But like he drives home this idea of most of the time when we're trying to do this, we end up just arguing with each other for the mm-hmm. most part. And this helps get rid of that argument and allows it to exist in a certain phase of the process, not across the entire meeting, which being a faculty member and sitting through meetings, all I can tell you is the amount of useless arguments that happen is just absolutely crazy. And we waste so much time because we're arguing over silly little things that like don't drive us forward at all. So yeah, he resonated with me there as well.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that sooner than you think, I believe, because let's go into the first part here, which is the white hat. And right away in chapter 4, he talks about how the white hat is just the facts without the argument. And this is where he really leans into this Western thinking, which is that we give a conclusion and then we share facts to support it. So if everybody takes that approach, it's really easy to see how the arguments arise. It reminds me of something that I wrote about actually in last week's newsletter that I picked up from Liminal Thinking by Dave Gray, which is that the internet specifically is a grocery store for facts. And you can find whatever fact you want to support whatever belief you want to have. And then you have people who are going through all this information to find specific things to reinforce these beliefs that they already have. And is it any wonder why like that's not productive and why there's so many internet philosophers who are willing to argue about anything and and everything. So the white hat is essentially don't view the information that way. And it actually talks about there's two types of facts here. There are believed facts and there are checked facts. And I don't think it's quite that simple. Like you can manipulate data to say whatever you want. So I think there has to be a little bit more nuance there with check facts. However, the way to have the most productive conversation with the people in your group is not to put forth something at a higher level than actually is the case. And one of the things I liked about this book, which is a recurring theme throughout all these chapters, is there's like a short paragraph or two about the concept and then like five different examples of how it might manifest through the mouth of somebody in a meeting, which is always in the book denoted by like three dots before the example. And there are so many that by the end of the book, it does feel a little bit laborious to keep reading those. But I do think that they provide excellent context and help you generalize like how this stuff can actually be used.
Yeah. Going back to that fact and truth, actually, let me start where you were. I agree. I got tired of those towards the end, but I don't think it was because they weren't valuable. I think it was because you had just seen so many of them by that time. It makes me think that this book would be really, really good if I was a facilitator or a leader or one of the people working people through the Six Hats process or the Six Hats method. Before I hit that hat, you know, I'm going to review and I'm going to say, okay, what would this look like in practice? What would this look like in practice? Going back to the facts, he makes a claim here that truth is not always fact. And then you talked about the internet being a repository of facts. And it's like, it all kind of gelled in my head. It's like the way he describes facts are, they're like the by and large, on the whole, mostly aligns, right? Like, and you can do that with anything, right? Like if you look hard enough, or if you dig down the right rabbit holes, you can say, well, for the most part, this is true. And it's like, and then you call that a fact. And then he can contrast that with truth. And truth is always something that aligns with a certain definition. So yep. Therefore, okay, here's the definition, and then here is truth, and those are the things that support that definition, or those are the pieces of data that go into that definition. And I thought that was a really interesting way to kind of separate those two ideas in my head. I'd never heard anybody present it that way.
Yeah, he's got a whole spectrum of likelihood, which is great, you know, where you start at the top, always true, usually true, generally true, by and large, more often than not, about half the time, often, sometimes true, occasionally true, but known to happen, never true, cannot be true. And I feel like just having those definitions, not that I'm going to memorize those or anything, having those in your vocabulary for when you're trying to figure out what are these facts and these figures that people are sharing, like which one of those does that apply to, could be really helpful. The other thing I loved in this section is chapter 6, Japanese style input. He talked about how Japanese meetings are not consensus meetings, which is really what most meetings devolve into that I've been a part of.
Yes.
So everyone can have their own ideas, and multiple ideas can be true. With the Western meetings that I've been a part of, it's like, let's get everybody convinced that this is the best thing to do. And there's a Jeff Bezos idea, like disagree but commit, which is helpful to kind of combat that. But this is even more effective, I think, the way that he's describing this, where you can have your idea, I can have my idea, and we're not going to have these preformed ideas. The goal of this meeting is not for me to win you over. It's just to listen. And then the other thing from this, which is the beginning of like the greenhouse idea, there's a Japanese notion that ideas emerge as seedlings and then are nurtured and allowed to grow into shape. And I think this is absolutely spot on. I said in the cohort just a couple of weeks ago that you don't know what an idea is when you have it. You have to give it time to mature. Everything seems like the best idea in the world the moment that you have it. And actually, there's a quote that I share that ideas are dangerous when they're an idea is most dangerous when it's the only one you have. Because you're like, this has to work. And I can totally see, as he's describing it here, how that's the Western approach is like, let's get an idea. Okay, this seems plausible. Let's make this happen without considering any of the other alternatives, which we'll get into in the other hats. But
yeah. Chapter 6 is where I called out the first discussion of a map, right? Where he first calls out the map idea. And basically that neutral input and then just listening. So you state your neutral input and then you step back and you listen. And what we're doing there is we're building the map. We're putting all the features on the map, and all the features on the map are the facts. And it's funny because I just had this happen to me earlier this week where we've been thinking about a thing for quite a while now. And then we got some more information and we started to do some analysis on it. And we went, oh my, the facts are very different than what we thought they were. Like if we just look objectively at the spreadsheet and the way things are, that's very different than what we thought they were. And it changed the way we thought about the map, right? We had this assumption or we had this thing before. So I really liked that idea. I think the last thing I'll do, because I feel like we're heading towards the next hat, would say the way he summarizes this at the very end was good to me. Basically, imitate a computer. Right? Yep. Like the computer doesn't do any argumentation. The computer doesn't do any, you know, kind of trying to sway you in any way. You ask it a question and it says, there are 100,000 records. Boom. Like, stop. Like, you know, and I like that idea because that put a good mental mindset that when I go into this is like, what's the white hat? The white hat is you asked me a question, I'm spitting back an answer and I'm giving you information and I'm going to stop right there. Now, whether AI is changing that, that's a whole other story, but, or large language models, whether they're changing, that's a whole other story. But like that, I like that analogy. I like the way to think about that like a computer.
Yeah. So when you're talking about thinking like a computer, essentially what you're saying is decoupling the emotion from the information. And you're right. That is the place to go into the next section. So the next part of this is the red hat. And the red hat is all about emotion and feeling. And this is another thing that I have been frustrated with in meetings is trying to remove this from the process. I mean, there are times when you want to do that, like you were just talking about the computer and the facts and the white hat thinking mode. But it's kind of stupid and naive to say don't make emotional decisions because they're going to weigh in at some point in the process. That's actually one of the big takeaways for me from this section is that if emotions and feelings are not permitted as inputs in the thinking process, they're going to lurk in the background. And he calls out, he's got a lot of these little lists, which are kind of spot on, but he talks about three points where emotion can affect your thinking. First, it can be affecting it by being a background emotion. Second, it can be triggered by an initial perception, so something that happens in a meeting, for example. And then the third way, and this is the productive way, is after the map has been put together. So kind of the brilliance of these hats is someone is responding emotionally to something in a meeting. You could say, okay, I recognize those emotions, but we're going to put on the white hat for right now, and we'll come back to that later. And that frees you to make the switch. One of the most frustrating things for me in a meeting is feeling like I am not being heard. And a lot of this comes down to like crappy facilitation. But one of the ways that you can put someone who is in that position, like make them feel heard and like instantly make the meeting more productive is not to say, you know, just put a pin in that, but to recognize like, okay, yeah, that's red hat thinking. That's good in its proper place, but that's not the place that we are right now. So I need you to switch to this other mode. And that doesn't mean that it happens automatically or that you always are in the right mode. That's the job of a good facilitator, is to make sure everybody's thinking about things the same way. But I love the fact that he calls out essentially that this is really important, but you also have to use it in the proper place.
Yep. I like that he also says everybody must tell their red hat or everybody must tell their emotion, which I think is really, really valuable because it's there, right? We've established the baseline that everybody has an emotion on this, even if your emotion is neutral. And he calls that out. He goes, maybe you don't have a very strong feeling on this. You're not excited or angry or whatever that is. You're just kind of neutral about it. State that. Like, make sure you state that. And I think what that does is that forces, in a good way, I don't mean this in a bad way, it forces people to actually go, oh, this is, like, if I'm willing to say this, this is actually what I feel about this. And then if you have established the baseline to where there is no bad emotion, you can feel however you need to feel about this or however you want to feel or whatever your gut is telling you feel about this, that's okay. Well, all we're doing right now is acknowledging the emotion because he calls out here that you don't have to justify it. If you start justifying the emotions in red hat thinking, you're doing it wrong because all you should be doing right now is calling out the emotion, is saying, I'm excited about this fact. I'm excited about this decision or this thing we're thinking through. I'm going to keep harping on this because I love the connection so much. he states here that thinking makes the map, values and emotion determine the route. And I really, really like thinking about it this way because, sure, thinking makes me lay out the land and these are all the facts I'm thinking about and these are maybe the paths through that. And then how do I make my decision? I always make my decision based on emotions. I like that one. I don't like that one. That one feels the best. I'm the most confident in this other one. You know, it's like I always make it based on values and emotion, even if it's wrong. Like even if I make the wrong decision and I know I'm making the wrong decision, I'm usually going to make it based on values and emotion, which I really connected with that piece too.
Yeah, I think this is maybe the most important section of the book for me because I tend to be pretty passionate and I have long fought for like productive meetings being ones where we have healthy conflict. And healthy conflict is where you're able to separate the ideas from the people who have them. The groups that I've been a part of, it feels like I can enter into that mode a lot easier than a lot of the other people that I've been in those situations with. And it's hard for me to hold back because I care so much about we gotta work through this. Let's not meet for 2 hours and then not accomplish anything and have the same meeting again next week. Like, why is that okay with anybody? It boggles my mind. So, like, there's obviously something here. Let's put our big boy pants on and let's just talk about it. But let's, you know, there are things that you can do in the meeting structure, like starting in on a positive focus. That's something we did at the day job prior to this that was really helpful. It definitely moved the needle here. But I've also seen how, like, whenever people get emotional about things, the default reaction in a lot of the meetings I've been in is to just kind of sweep it under the rug. It's like, well, that's a bad thing, and you just got to cool down and come back tomorrow when you don't feel so strongly. And I'm like, that just makes it worse.
Yes, it does.
He talks in here about legitimizing the emotions, and you hit on something. You said that you don't have to have a justification for it. Now, I think that's the other thing that I feel, because of the responses I've seen from people, it's like, I have to have a justification for these emotions. So it's kind of freeing to me to hear, like, no, you can just feel what you feel. But I think there's another thing that this ties to something from a previous book that we read, and I'm blanking on the book, but I know that I talked to you about this in the last couple episodes, where one of my action items was not saying you did this and then it made me feel this way, but I feel this way because this happened. And for me, this is like the perfect combination of like the white and the red hat. The red hat is I'm feeling this way and I don't have to justify why I feel this way. But the thing that has triggered this emotion, if I look at it objectively, is this information, which is not coupled to positive, negative judgment, but this thing that happened. We're not going to discuss whose fault it is, but it's a thing that happened. And that is the thing that caused me to feel this way. I feel like understanding that connection can be really valuable. It's just when you attach it to somebody else and we judge other people by their actions, ourselves by our intentions, and we say, oh, well, you did this on purpose to get under my skin, that's where things get unhealthy.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I mean, he talks about how, you know, one of the reasons why you don't justify is because they can be fickle. And I can tell you from personal experience, there are times when I'm just, you know, I get into a meeting and something happens and I'm like, well, that's dumb. Like, that's just a dumb idea. And then 30 minutes later, an hour and a half later, I'm like, actually, that really wasn't a dumb idea. I don't know why I thought it was a dumb idea in that meeting, but I had that strong emotion, which is fine. Like, it was there. And then later on, I have a completely different emotion. To round that out, the book you're referencing was the Difficult Conversations book. That's where,
oh, right.
That's where
obviously
that was in.
Yeah. Should have thought of that one.
Yep.
All right.
Black hat?
Yeah, let's go to the black hat. So the black hat is maybe the one that I operate in most naturally. and I don't think I'm naturally a negative or pessimistic person, but I guess after reading through this whole book and realizing the different hats, I kind of noticed that I go back and forth in these different modes sort of naturally. And I feel like not always because I'm the facilitator of the meetings, but I see the need for these additional perspectives. This is the one that traditionally the groups I've been involved in, people don't want to touch this one.
Really?
So yeah, yeah. And it's hard for me because like someone will be sharing an idea. Oh, this is amazing. We should just totally go for it. And in the back of my mind, I'm like holding back. Cause I'm like, I see about a dozen ways that this could go sideways. And I'm going to let somebody else say something. And then the longer it goes with nobody else saying anything, I feel like more bricks get put in the backpack that I'm carrying. And I feel this like stress and anxiety. I'm like, how does nobody see this? You know, so then I'll say it because I feel like it needs to be said. And then if you don't have a healthy atmosphere, like that comes across as, well, you're attacking my idea, therefore you're attacking me. I don't know. Maybe I just haven't been in enough like really high functioning teams in my life.
What I think is interesting is he calls this out as the most used. He says in most meetings, this is the most used. And you have the opposite scenario where the meetings you're in for whatever, you know, special magic group of people that you have, they are the opposite of this. They are the yellow hat people, right? And you're the black hat person in the room. So that's interesting. I do not have that same experience. Most of the meetings I'm in, this cautious, careful, survival, you know, ethical kind of thing, that's 100% what governs 99% of the meeting. And then we have to really fight for anything else in the meeting.
Yeah, well, I should clarify this a little bit because I feel like there is a baseline level for an effective meeting, which is you have to have an agenda. And there are some groups that I'm in that don't even get to that point.
So that would be for those of you who want to know where we're going, that would be the blue hat thinking of this whole situation.
So once you have the agenda, then I think the default can be to go into the black hat thinking. And there are definitely times in my working life specifically where we have the agenda and this is the purpose of the meeting. And I can totally see how not me, but other people have gotten stuck in this particular area. And in that instance, it's frustrating to me because I feel like, okay, we're going to talk about this thing. And the black hat just keeps throwing out more and more scenarios. Oh, well, we got to get more and more information. And so I had to embrace a different role where it's like, no, we have enough information. Let's just make a decision. There's 10 things on our agenda for this 90-minute meeting, and we've spent 75 minutes talking about the first one, which is not even the most important one. Mm-hmm. So let's move along here, people. It's going to be okay, which is not a natural thing for me, but I guess I see the need to embrace a different role, and so I'll jump in there. It's always uncomfortable for me to do that. And I think, side note here, that these different hats, he talks about how everyone needs to be able to go back and forth between these different hats. So you can't hide behind the justification of, oh, well, my personality is naturally this way. That's a data point. That's fine. You can use that, but you need to get over that at some point. And learn to think different ways. And I do think that the way that he's talking about these different approaches, thinking is a skill. He actually talks later on about how creativity is a skill. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Those two are very much linked. But if you can learn to think better, then you can have more productive meetings. And that's really, you know, there's another aspect of this where you can switch between these different modes on an individual level. But I really do think where this gets multiplied exponentially in terms of its effectiveness is when you have a team of people, probably at least 5 or 6 people, where you have to have some sort of baseline framework of this is how we're going to do this, like a shared rules of engagement.
I would agree with you. I think he calls out a couple different things that you were touching on and you maybe hit, and I want to re-hit those. Is we're all going to have some way that we're wired. So I can tell you I'm wired green hat, yellow hat, right? If I look at this, I'm wired green hat, yellow hat. So for me to do the other things, I have to, you know, think about those a little bit harder. But like you said, you can't hide behind that. You still have to engage in the full process. Another one, he calls out the fact that black is the most used hat to be critical. Most people find it easy to be critical. And he says, do that. That's great. We need you to be critical. But if we're not in black hat thinking mode, just write it down and let it go. Because if not, you're going to be that person who's always going to throw out that critical idea when we're not in that part of our thinking. And it's not that you shouldn't capture that. It's just a matter of this isn't when we're supposed to think about this. And you're going to end up derailing the meeting, which is what you're getting at is 75 yeah. minutes of we're still on agenda item number one. Why? Because everybody just kept harping on these things. I think he does a really good job where he says it comes from past experience. And essentially our black hat thinking is how does this fit with past experience? How does this fit with our strategy? How does this fit with the ethics and the values that we hold? And what we're doing in black hat thinking is we're trying to resolve all of that at the same time. And resolve, I don't think it's the right word, but you know what I mean? Like we're trying to figure that all that at the same time is, does this fit with my past experience? Does this fit with my ethics and my values? Does this fit with the strategy that I think we're supposed to be going on? And that's where the critical nature of it comes in. And that's good. Just don't do it too much. Don't go overboard with it.
The other thing with this is that overuse of the black hat can be ego-driven. So it's tied to like, I need to make sure I get my way, or a less distasteful version of that maybe is I need to make sure that I'm being heard. So a lot of yes. times I feel like the overuse of the black hat is simply a bad facilitator. But then the other thing that goes with this, and you were kind of hitting on this, that it's easy to be critical. So he mentions chapter 20, it's easier to be critical than it is to be constructive. So anytime that you're going to be in black hat thinking, you have to have the understanding that we're talking about the idea, not about the person who had it. Okay, so now let's pick this apart. But then let's not just pick it apart to be like, oh, well, that's a terrible idea. But maybe there's a way we can redeem this. Maybe we can turn this around in some way. Because black hat is all about like pointing out the problems. But those problems can be overcome. And so I think that's the other thing that frustrates me with this is that's how I tend to view things. It's like, okay, so you want to do this. Well, I don't think that's a great idea because X, Y, Z, but I understand where you're coming from. And maybe we should try a different approach with that same thing. And what if we did it this way instead? I kind of go back and forth between that pretty easily, but it bothers me when people get stuck and like, no, this is why we can't. And then I've seen other people who are like at the top of the food chain in the meetings and like, I'm sick of you telling me that we can't do this stuff all the time. Like, what are we like? Can we do something, please? Seems like a lot of visionaries are like that. They just want to do something. So maybe they're more naturally yellow hat, and the integrators like me are more naturally black hat. I don't know.
Well, and what you're calling out is you're calling out what he would call, so you said problems, right? But you're calling out obstacles, risks, these caution points. And this was the point I was trying to get to at the very end. If you heard me trying to trail off on the last thing, I was trying to get to tying it into the map, right? So these are when we're drawing our map, these are where we put the caution points is, oh, we need to be careful here. We need to be careful here. We need to be cautious in this area. And again, if you think about this from a, what are we trying to do? We're trying to make a decision. We're trying to take action. So the point of all of the six hats thinking is to be able to make a decision and take action. We need that. We need to know the caution points. We need to know where the risks are in order to see our way through the map and actually figure out a route and make our way through. And I think what he's trying to get at here and really trying to drive home in this chapter is just don't do it too much. If your whole map is caution points, there's no route through there, right? Like if everything is sharks and lasers, you're never going to make it, never going to make it through.
I like that. Everything is sharks and lasers. I'm totally stealing that. Anything else on the black hat? Because that actually is a great segue into the next section here.
Nope. Let's go yellow.
Okay. So the next section is the yellow hat. And this is kind of the yin for the yang with the black hat. If the black hat is about, I'll say negativity, but not necessarily. It's more nuanced than that. But that's how it can come across. Well, the yellow hat is explicitly being positive. And one of the things that I appreciate about the description here of the yellow hat is that being positive is a choice. So you can't hide behind that, well, I'm just naturally a glasses half empty type of person. No, you can choose to be positive. If you don't want to choose to be positive, then maybe there are some other issues you got to work through. But it's something that you can click into. And he says in the very first section here, chapter 22, that self-interest is a strong basis for positive thinking. And just like all of the other hats, it does require discipline. So it's not just, well, I feel good today, so I'm naturally a little bit more optimistic. And I think the yellow hat and the black hat are kind of two different modes that probably are next to each other. They talk about how there's a lot of different ways that you can implement this. The role of the facilitator is to say, we're going to be in this mode now, and then we're going to this mode. There are several points throughout the book where they lay out kind of some examples of how, if you're going through something, you might go from this to this to this to this. However, with the black and the yellow hat, I feel like this is the one that I can naturally see going back and forth between these most effectively. And just as an example, you got your agenda items, you know, these different decisions that we have to make, and we're looking at these one by one. Okay, let's black hat this. Okay, let's yellow hat this. Mm-hmm. What's the decision that we're going to make? Next item. Okay, black hat, yellow hat. Like, yep. This seems pretty easy to, at least in principle, to implement, although probably it's a little bit tricky to get people thinking in this way. I've experienced this too with the previous job of, okay, so now we have a whole bunch of reasons why this thing might not work, but what if this were successful? And this is literally part of the life theme cohort too, is like, well, what if what you did was going to be successful no matter what? You couldn't fail. What would you possibly do? And so I've recognize the value of having those questions or those prompts kind of funnel you down a specific path. And because it's not natural to me, whenever I do it, I get excited. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. Let's do this thing.
Yeah. I think in 23, he calls out the positive spectrum. And I can't remember how many like levels he gave on the spectrum. What I wrote down in my notes is basically there's the logical, practical, you know, optimism, benefits, positive spectrum. And then there's the over-optimistic. And this really, really got me, because I can picture the people in the meetings I've been in where it's like, okay, you are the logical, practical optimist or positive thinker. And then you are the person who's like, you're just too much, right? Like, come on, you gotta tone that down a little bit. And I'm not saying we don't need both of those people in the meeting, but it was like really, it was really good. And we're probably going to say this later when we do style and rating. I think one of the reasons why this book hit so well with me is because it is not difficult. If you've done any meeting leadership, any facilitation, if you've done any working with groups trying to make a decision or trying to steer the group into decision making, I mean, you see all of this in practice. Like, you absolutely see almost everything he points out to a T, and you're like, wow, I've witnessed that quite a few times. I've done that. Somebody, you know, my buddy's done that or this other thing. So I really like that. A key point he makes in chapter 23 is optimism needs to lead to action. There needs to be an expectation to succeed. So we can't just be optimistic for the sake of being optimistic. We need to be optimistic because it actually gets us to making a decision, taking an action, some level of success. Or else it's just fruitless, right? Like, what's the point of us being optimistic about a thing? We got to make sure we can see that vision going through there.
Yeah, he mentions that without yellow hat thinking, there's no progress. And he talks about how yellow hat thinking is positive judgment. So it's exploring the and probing for value and benefit. And when you see that stuff, I feel like that's when motivation and clarity come. So a lot of this is tied for me to like the personal retreat process. But I have to admit, like having read this book, I'm kind of jonesing for another opportunity to be in a meeting with a bunch of other people and practice some of this stuff. Like, I don't see a day-to-day application for a lot of this, and I'm kind of disappointed.
So you're going to go back and get a real job job, and you're going to just lead a meeting to use six hats, right?
I don't think so. But that would be cool. I mean, the idea of being like a business coach has always been interesting to me. We were working with a business coach, and they were following this. It's called Pinnacle, and it's like a mashup of different stuff from Patrick Lencioni and Scaling Up and big game of business. Like, there's all these different tools essentially, and you can pick the ones that you want to use when you're facilitating a group. And I always thought like the role that the guy was that we were working with was doing was something that would be really awesome. But you would have to have the right group of people. That was always the thing that kind of held me back, because I saw how our team kind of got stuck in some of this stuff, and he's trying to pull us back out. And so I almost want to like go over to his office and give him a copy of this book and be like, here, next time you work with annoying people like us, you should totally use this.
Oh man, that's great. So I'm the opposite. I mean, I have the opportunity to use this multiple times a week. And when we get to action items, I'll talk more in more detail about this, but I was so excited about what was being presented here, and it was so relevant that I basically started using this in my capstone design course, where in a capstone design course, we start out with basically a problem space. And our goal by the end of the capstone design project would be to deliver value for the client. Now, I don't want to say make a thing. I don't want to say write a report. I don't want to say give a presentation. It all just depends on what the client needs, right? So the client is going to help us determine what value makes the most sense for them. And then we're going to also contribute into that value. But like, this was so relevant into the world of working with my capstone design students that we actually implemented it. And I'll tell you about it when we get to action items, because that's going to be one of my moving forward action items. But that value idea or that vision, you know, he calls out in chapter 26, basically vision precedes design. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that I think really resonates with what you do with like the life theme and with what you do with a lot of the work that you're doing is if we don't have that vision, if we don't have that understanding, we can't really design a system, or we can't really design a work life where, you know, or a framework that actually helps us to get to where we want to go and get to the value that we want to add into the world. And it's what we do with the academic workshop that I lead, right? It's like, we're trying to help people get to that vision and get to that idea. And one of the things you have to do in vision is you have to figure out what are the benefits and what is the feasibility. And when you figure out what the benefits and the feasibility are, that sets your direction, or it helps you set your direction, which then gets you to that overall design that's going to let you actually produce value and provide value for people. So again, I mean, I know I keep going on and the number of things that kind of really stood out and really resonated with me, but that was a huge one, is that vision precedes design and how you work through that. Are you good for me to transition us into Green Hat?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so the last thing he calls out in chapter 27 is the fact that constructive thinking, which is what we're doing in Yellow Hat, right? It's value, it's benefit, it's how is this effective, right? That's your Yellow Hat thinking. It is not creative thinking. So the constructive idea doesn't necessarily mean you're being creative or whatever that is. It really just means you're adding value. You're figuring out ways to provide benefit. Creative comes into change, innovation, newness. It's how do we make the thing and make it new? And that leads us into Green Hat thinking. So I really liked his separation between those two, because a lot of people, I've heard you say this before, it's like, oh, I'm not creative. Well, hold on, right? Like, what is creative, right? Creative doesn't mean constructive. So maybe you are just naturally wired to be more yellow and you're not as green naturally, but that doesn't mean you can't be green. It just means you have to think about it in a little bit of a different way. And now I'll let you intro green for us.
Well, I actually think I'm a little bit more green than yellow, because the thing that I always struggled with was that initial brainstorming piece. So that was a perfect segue. Thanks for setting that up. But the Yellow Hat thinking can identify an opportunity is how he framed it in chapter 27. But then they leave it to the Green Hats to figure out a way to take advantage of it. If someone were to tell me, this is what we're doing, figure out how to make it happen, that's my wheelhouse. Now yeah, we're talking.
Yeah.
But it was the generating the initial ideas that I initially struggled with for a while. So I really like the fact that he decoupled those, because it's really easy to meld those together in your brain. It's like, oh, well, the idea and then the execution of it are all like the same step. It's not. And when you go into the Yellow Hat mode, you get all the options. You know, what are all the possibilities? The Green Hat is kind of where like, okay, so let's consider each one of these. How do we actually make this happen? And this requires you to look at things in a different way. And for whatever reason, this has always been kind of the easy part for me. It's like, well, we want to do this, but we can't do it this specific way. So what are the other ways that we could do this? Okay, so that one makes sense now. Bing, 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 bing. Here's all the things that need to happen in order for us to get to that point. And I like the term that he uses in chapter 29 of deliberate creative thinking. I never really thought about that thought process as deliberate creative thinking, but I totally can see it now. And again, you know, like you're right. I did say at one point, I guess I'm just not creative. If I had read this book before and I understood what the green hat really was, I don't think I ever would have said that. I might have said it a different way. I might have said something along the lines of, I'm not good at coming up with ideas, but I wouldn't have defined the generation of those ideas specifically as creativity, which is what it was in my mind for a really long time.
Yeah, I like that he calls out that green hat thinking is what we could do. So it's all of these different ways of what we could do to achieve the yellow hat, to achieve the benefit, to achieve the effectiveness. It's all the different ways we could do that. And then he links it directly to red hat. And he said, if you make too many of those, which if you've got some good green hats there, or you know, people are really doing well in the green hat, you're going to have too many ideas. You can't act on them all. So how do we figure out which one we work on? We red hat it, right? Which one do I like? Which one do I feel good about? Which one do I have the hunch, the intuition, the thing that says, oh, we should move forward there. And I think what I like about this is it ties into a thing that he doesn't talk about directly. And if he did, correct me where I'm wrong, but he doesn't talk about it directly, is there's this experience level where we're going to be able to tap into, and it's within Red Hat, I believe, right? That's where I think I would put it, and probably he would put it. There's this experience level where we're going to have all these ideas, and we're going to see the map, and we're going to be able to know the direction, and we're going to say, we should pick this idea. And you're going to go, why? And the reason why you're going to pick that idea is because it just feels right. And if you have the right people in that room, they're all going to go, yeah, we think you're right. Like, we think you're right. We think, like, that's the one we would pick too. And honestly, I think that's the right idea, right? Because you're bringing collective intelligence into the room, and you're letting people group together and say, like, okay, we all feel confident on that. But then the other thing you're doing is you're tying into ownership. Oh, we made a choice together collectively to do that. And then you can bring your other thinking in, right? Like, you can bring your argumentative thinking in and say, hold on, there's a whole group of people over here that thinks this other way. And then you can have another session, essentially, like a mini session through this, to say, all right, we feel really good about these two. Which one do we pick, and how do we pick that? And then you run through these other thinking, hat thinking processes. So I really liked kind of how all of this is coming together full circle, if you will, right? Like, you can see this actually happening in practice, and you can see this actually going into being a productive thing, where in the beginning, when he says, hey, this has worked at like all these different companies and we've saved them time and we've saved them all this money. And you're like, okay, really? Like, I mean, yeah, sure. That's easy for you to say about your own technique that you're developing. But then you're kind of like, you know, you're in chapter 29 and you're like, well, okay, maybe I can actually see how this would be that effective.
It does require you, though, to have a team that is built on trust. You're talking about like green hat generating options. That's one of the main things that stood out to me from this, is that most people stop thinking when they get an answer to a problem, and then they try to force it in like a square peg in a round hole. It actually says in chapter 33, life isn't like school. There's often more than one right answer, which I thought was pretty brilliant. So the scenario that you're describing there is like, okay, this feels like the right answer. Even if it's not, I trust you, and I know that we'll give this an honest shot, and then if it doesn't work, we'll come back and we'll try one of the other options. So it's not like I really have to fight to the death for my idea because it's now or never, which is a really negative mindset that people fall into when you're in these meetings that are way longer than they have to be, and you're trying to collect all the information. You want to get to the point where you're constantly having movement and you're constantly trying things. That's where I think the green hat is really, really positive and really helpful, is that you constantly have all of these alternatives that you can fall back on if that one thing doesn't work. And because you have these other options, you don't have to put all your stock into this one idea. This really has to change the company. This one idea, like, this is going to change our entire working life. No, you can just be curious with it. You can hold it lightly and be like, well, that one didn't work. I'll go try the next one. And mm-hmm. eventually you do find something that works if that is the approach.
And the crux of it is the fact that they're all good ideas because you've evaluated them with yellow hat thinking or with black hat thinking. So they're all viable ideas, right? And it kind of sets that baseline. So no, I like that a lot. Okay, Mike, here's where the book kind of takes a little digression for me. So chapters 30, 31, 32, 33, maybe 34, right? But actually more just, it stops at 33. I feel like he was just like, okay, I got to nerd out for a minute. Like I really have to, I got to tap into this lateral thinking thing. And I really just need to like put my uber nerd hat on and here we go. Like here is lateral thinking. And the thing that sold it for me on the nerd out was he introduced the idea of Poe.
Yeah. Right?
Like so. Yep. So when this Poe thing came in, I was like, "Wait a minute! Like, what are we talking about here with Poe?" So let me try to give you a decent summary. Oh, and that's the other name of the book. So that's funny. I forgot it. The book is called Poe: Beyond Yes and No. Right. Mm-hmm. Which I mean, like all of this stuff here is
sounds like a preschool book.
Exactly. Like I'm starting to go, like okay, what do we get ourselves into? Okay, lateral thinking. Right. So movement forward. We're thinking about stepping stones, but what we're trying to think about is how do we introduce a provocation that shifts us into some other pattern or that allows us to get into some other pattern? Go ahead.
So real quick, lateral thinking, the definition here, which I think will be useful, is pattern switching on an asymmetric patterning system. So you get stuck in a single pattern. Lateral thinking is like taking the train off of that set of tracks, putting it on another set of tracks.
That's a really good analogy. I had not thought about it as a train moving over to the other set of tracks. I like that a lot. So he talks about this lateral thinking. And it's like, and then the Poe idea is this Poe is this provocation. The Poe is this push. The Poe is this thing that gets us to think about it in a different way. Right? And it's got three results. We are unable to do that. So we can't actually move the train to another set of tracks. We drift back, so we move it to another set of tracks, and then it makes its way back
here.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think more often than not, that's a very common thing. Is like, oh, well, we tried this thing, and then a week later, we're like, yeah, we're just back to where we've always been. Because that makes sense. You're in a groove, right? You get into that rut, and you get into that groove.
Yep.
And then his last one, and I think where he really wants you to move is you switch to that actually new pattern. And that new pattern is what allows you to advance and allows you to move forward in a good way. And then he gives some ideas on this, but this is like, so I'll stop my little soapbox here. This was, it felt different. It was like, wait a minute, what are we doing? Like you were six hats and practical and all this stuff. And now we're going to go lateral thinking and Poe and da, 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 da. And then we come back in chapter 34, but I'm intrigued at what you thought about that whole section.
I guess having heard you describe it, I can see how it feels a little bit shoehorned in, but I didn't really have that impression when I was reading it. I mean, he does talk about how lateral thinking was the term that he invented in 1967. And then the Poe idea I thought was a little bit weird, like a cutesy name on a concept that maybe we don't need an acronym for that. Although he does give a bunch of examples.
I was going to say, like, do you remember him, how he got to him?
Yeah, I do. So I see it as like a triggering mechanism. Like you could use this strategic ways, just let's blue sky, that different hat, but big picture, like what are all the possibilities here? Even if it doesn't seem like it's something we can possibly do, just like give me all the ideas. So I think it's an effective vehicle. Maybe the description feels a little bit weird, but you're right. He definitely wants to nerd out about this and he's got a whole nother book on lateral thinking. So it kind of makes me want to go deeper onto that concept, but I didn't actually buy any other books having read this one. I'm not sure if I will. And I don't know. I kind of, when I got done, was like, that's good enough for me. I feel like a lot of the things that he talks about in this book and in this section specifically, because it's kind of tied to this idea of creativity, are things that I've been thinking about for a long time, and he brought a different perspective, which I was appreciative of. but it wasn't anything that felt like revolutionary or new to me necessarily. He's got some specific frameworks for how do you actually use this with a group, which are probably a little bit more effective. I tend to just be like, how am I going to use this? So I don't need to codify all this for like, hey, everyone, when we're doing this, these are the rules, until I do a cohort and then I have to explain it to people. That's my forcing mechanism.
Yep.
But
So just to round it out, let's put a bow on this. PO stands for provocation operation. So that's what PO stands for. And where, you know, you talked about like not necessarily needing, you know, feeling like you needed to go read more on this, where this trip to me that said, oh, this is actually interesting and I would probably use this in a different way. If I was still doing a lot of educational research, this idea would have probably found its way into my educational research, is because what is the provocation operation that gets lateral thinking into the educational process for engineers? What is the hypothesis, or how do I suppose something, or how do I make this possible idea that takes somebody who comes in and says, I'm not cut out to be an engineer, or I can't pass math, or whatever it is, and shifts them, like moves them to that other set of tracks that says, oh no, I can do this, right? Like I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. This is where this idea comes in and I could see myself moving it forward. I don't have that context anymore. Like that's not the kind of work that I do anymore, but I could really see myself digging into this if I was still in that space.
Yeah, it makes sense. All right, ready to blue hat?
I am ready to blue hat.
All right, so this is the last official section. The blue hat, as mentioned previously, is at another level. So this is kind of like above all of the other hats. I wish there was a visual for like a org chart for the hats, but I guess that would really be it. It's like the blue hat on a separate level of everything else. That seems kind of funny to me. But with the blue hat, specifically what we're doing is we're no longer thinking about the subject. We're thinking about the thinking instead. So I think it's in this section where he talks about how blue hat is not concerned about like where the car is going, but it's watching the driver. And I like that analogy a lot. I feel like this one is pretty easy to grok, very difficult to administer, because essentially a lot of the blue hat stuff is like the role of the facilitator. Now, you don't have to be the facilitator. He even calls that out specifically, that anybody can be in the blue hat mode, but basically says that if you are the facilitator, you have to be functioning in the blue hat mode, because the blue hat thinker is kind of like the conductor of the orchestra. And I like that analogy a lot too, because I grew up playing violin. I've played in orchestras, and I get this picture of like a conductor who has no idea what he's doing, no idea how to communicate to any of the instruments, and a whole bunch of like middle school kids who just like banging things together and making noise, and then trying to like coordinate all of that into a pleasant sound. Like it's really, really hard.
Yep. I was a percussionist, right? And I can tell you right now.
You were that guy.
As soon as we put mallets in our hands, or you put cymbals in our hands, I mean, what are we going to, like, it's like telling us not to push the red button, and we just want to push the red button. So if the conductor's not going to give you the cue, I mean, you're just going to start pushing the red button, and then you get yelled at and all that. So I agree here. The other analogy he makes, is the choreographer. Sorry, the choreographer. I knew I wasn't saying that right. But he says, you know, you're choreographing the sequence of steps that we're going to run through here. And what I like about this is he said, blue hat, if you're the facilitator, there is no one standard way to work through this. You have to think about what your goal is. You have to think about what you need out of the meeting. You have to think about what you need out of the session, and then choreograph it in a way that makes sense, and set it up in a way. And then we get into the conductor side, where now I'm going to actually try to make that happen in real life, right? So I like the fact that he has a lot of different, you know, word pictures here that really bring out the idea of what it would be like to be a blue hat. And then, like I've done so many times this episode, he still links it back to that map, right? Like we're still trying to build that map. What does the blue hat do? The blue hat is the person who helps us build that map. So our input through the different hats and putting on the different hats is providing what's going to go on that map. But how do we build the map? Well, that's the blue hat's job to help us work through that. That's the structure. He or she is structuring our conversations.
They're also responsible for breaking up the arguments.
Yep.
Which is kind of interesting. And it makes sense. The blue hat is essentially the one that is saying, okay, we're going to go into this specific mode. So I can totally see scenarios where it's like, okay, that's black hat thinking, but we're done with that for now. You need to put on the yellow hat or the green hat, whatever, instead. That's red hat thinking. That's valid, but we'll get to that later. And I feel like this is really where the method works or doesn't work, is if you have that type of facilitator. Like, I don't think it's enough to just share this book or these descriptions with your team and be like, okay, now we're going to do this. We're going to self-organize and make this happen. Like, there has to be a conductor for this orchestra.
I agree. The last part in this one before we roll is the fishing questions and the shooting questions.
Yeah.
If I thought about this harder, I might not land on fishing and shooting, but I like the fact that he called out the fact that there's different questions. So there are questions that, as the facilitator or the leader, I'm gonna say, basically, we want to explore a space with this question. So that's the fishing question. He would call that the fishing question, is, what are we doing? We're really just fishing for information. We're fishing for ideas. We're fishing for emotions. We're fishing for benefits and values. So all the different hats, like, we're fishing in that area to figure out what that might be. Then other ones are shooting questions, where we're basically trying to shoot a target and we're trying to get to a yes or no. And we say, hey, let's check out this point. Let's think about this point. And what it might mean is, let's put the white hat on, think about this point, and somebody comes in with a fact and we go, oh, okay, boom, that's done. Like that that fact just doesn't exist. Or they come out with a black hat thinking and the risk is just too high. And we know that the risk is just too high. So boom, like that type of thinking gets done. So we're trying to get to essentially like a quicker decision on that. And I thought that was a really good way, because I've used that in meetings, not calling it this at all. But it's like, here we're just exploring a space. Here we're actually trying to see, is that true? Like, are we actually, was what we're saying actually true here? Or is that emotion valid in this situation?
Yeah, I like those different types of questions a lot too. And that is from the chapter on focus, which obviously I like.
Yes, I like that chapter. You would like that chapter.
So this is interesting though, because you've probably heard focus described as a muscle, and it's the kind of ability that you can develop. And in this chapter, they kind of talk about how you can kind of push people into a focus mode by asking them a question. Asking a question is the simplest way to focus thinking. And that's where they get into the two types of questions, where we're going to explore all the options or just give me a simple yes or no. They also talk about how focus can be broad or narrow. We probably typically think of it as narrow. I'm going to focus on this one specific thing and disregard everything else. But that's not really what focus is. If you think about it in terms of a camera, you can have the thing in the foreground, you can have the thing in the background. So there's a lot of different elements to this. And I think this is a new perspective on the whole idea of focus, which is really powerful. But it also kind of highlights and helps me understand, even though I could never really codify it this way previously, the thinking time questions. Like, I've always had a thing for questions. That's why I love Personal Socrates so much by Mark Champagne. It's these little character studies, and then each section, there's like 50 or 60 of them, has a question that you can use to kind of reflect on, and then it kind of opens up some different ideas, kind of helps you to think about things different ways. So I like and have long believed for a long time that if you ask the right question, you will find the right answer, but didn't really make the connection, at least as explicitly as he did here, that when you ask the question in a certain way, what that does is it focuses your thinking. I don't know why. I never really thought about it that way. I've got like the retrospective parts of my personal retreat, and that's exactly what I've been doing for years, but I never defined it that way. And so it helped me understand it a little bit more completely.
Yeah. All right, so the last thing he talks about with blue hat thinking would be the idea that a blue hat thinker summarizes. They are the record keeper. They are the person who is essentially responsible for the final report, not necessarily has to write the whole final report, but they're the person who makes sure that that gets done so we don't lose it and we don't lose all the work that we did. And, you know, and this just ties back into what you've said a few different times, is they're the facilitator. They're the leader. They're the person who is mainly high-level accountable. The person who is mainly high-level accountable tends to wear the blue hat in terms of guiding the process, controlling the show, monitoring progress through that. And that's actually the title of chapter 41 is control and monitoring, and how does the blue hat play into control and monitoring?
Right. Should we go to the conclusion?
Let's do it. Is this chapter, hold on, are we doing chapter 42, or are we doing, no, I'm kidding.
Well, okay. So chapter 42, the first chapter 42 is in the blue hat section. Yeah. So it's a summary of the blue hat thinking, which I kind of liked how they have those summary. It's just like a one page thing at the end of every section. Those summaries must have been added in the revised and updated, because there is a separate chapter after that section, which is still labeled chapter 42.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't have a whole lot from that. I didn't take any notes from that. I incorporated one specific idea from that into a separate section in my MindNode file, which I just called the conclusion. So yeah. I guess if we're going to call out that piece specifically, the thing I jotted down from there is that in the end, all decisions are emotional.
Yes.
So there's no, like, this is obviously the right decision because of all these facts. You do have to just, I believe this is the right decision, and make a choice. But I think that actually fits nicely with a lot of the other stuff that's in the conclusion. So if I were to rework this, I would actually just combine those, get rid of that second chapter 42, and there is just the conclusion. But a couple of big ideas from the conclusion. It's pretty short. It's only like a page or two, if I remember right. The biggest enemy to thinking is complexity. So we want to simplify things, and that's what the six hats does, is it simplifies thinking by allowing the thinker to deal with one thing at a time. And then it also gives you an escape hatch that allows you to switch between different thinking, and not every moment of thinking is going to require this six hats model. And also it works best when used as a common language for a group. And I totally can see that. And it's a great way to summarize this. And I feel like that last part specifically, that works best when used as a common language for a group, sets up for, okay, I'm reading this, I'm getting excited, I want to implement this with my team. That kind of leads naturally into the action item, which is essentially, I don't have one specifically because I don't have a group that I'm going to use this with, but it would be to present this to the groups and teams that I'm a part of potentially and be like, hey, I think this is really helpful. Can we try this out and get everybody on board, and then follow up with, okay, who's going to be the facilitator? They're going to wear the blue hat, yada, yada, yada. So it's a great way to summarize and kind of lead into what you would do with this short book. I mean, I say short, it's like 170 pages, but it felt a lot shorter than that.
I agree completely. I'm admittedly a slow reader, and this book was not hard to consume. Like, it was not hard to work through. I felt like it was written in a way that actually made a lot of sense and then flowed really well. The only addition I'll have for the conclusion from my notes, it's funny because three out of my four, you hit on right on the money. I mean, they were exactly what I had written down. The other one I have is that the six hats thinking makes the final choice obvious. And here is where I'm a tiny little bit skeptical, because I want to run this. I mean, I trust that it made it obvious for him in the groups he's worked with, but I would want to run this and say, hold on, does it actually make it obvious? I think it might. I think setting the map, figuring out the route through the map, sure, that has a potential to make it obvious, but does it really make it obvious? So we'll roll into my action items now, because you gave yours. So I'm going to use this throughout the rest of the semester with my senior capstone design. So this is a long-term action item. It won't necessarily be something that's easy to follow up on next time. From the tiny little bit that I used it with my capstone design course that I talked about a little bit before, I already saw the value in it. Now, we weren't at the point where we needed to make any specific decisions, but we needed to think through some complex ideas, and I could sense a little bit of frustration with some of the students in the capstone design course about the way the project was going, or the way certain aspects of the projects were going. And what I think it brought is, I think it brought clarity to it. The thing that was really fun for me was, I thought they were going to roll their eyes, like monster roll, like, oh my gosh, he wants us to do this six hats thinking, blah, 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 blah. But when I pitched it to them and I said, this is a way to simplify your thinking, it's a way to kind of keep us all on the same page and not let us get distracted in these conversations. So just for a little context, there are, 11 students in the room. So there's a lot of voices in the room plus me. So there's a decent number of voices in the room. And they actually all engaged really well. Like, they were all like, okay, like, we'll give it a shot. Like, let's see how this goes. And I think through the very short session that we did with it, there was clarity. Like, we actually gained clarity. We thought about things in a way that made sense for people to think about them, not in a muddled way as we work through. So one of my action items is I want to keep trying to apply this to my Capstone Design course. The second action item I have is I want to look up the book Poe, Beyond the Yes or No. Right? And I'm not going to tell you I'm going to read it. I just want to look it up and see if I think it's worth reading.
Okay.
So there's an interest enough there that I want to see if it's worth reading or if I think lateral thinking might be a better one to read.
I have to admit, when I hear the word Poe, I think of Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
I don't know the reference, okay.
It's really not worth explaining. They're like, okay. Yeah, it's a form of currency in the game.
Okay.
So not at all related to what he talked about. I actually don't have any specific action items with this, but I think this is awesome. Like if I had an action item, it would be to go back to the business coach that we worked with and tell him about this because I think it would be helpful. We even had, when we were doing our meetings, a different version of this, which was not nearly as effective. And I forget the specifics of it because it was like a year ago. But he had like little animals that he placed on the table. And basically when we felt that we were being steamrolled or something, we could grab the elephant, or felt like someone was just making things a little too personal, we could grab the donkey, you know. And I feel like get rid of those stupid animals, because with those, it's essentially saying like, you're doing this and I'm feeling this way.
Yeah.
So it's not explicit, but it kind of is. Like the fact that I'm saying something and somebody grabs something, I'm like, well, why do you feel that way? Like, I'm just talking about this idea. Just decouple it from your identity and mm-hmm. we're fine. But I feel like having the visuals in the meeting is a really cool idea. So I can see him like totally loving this idea of like, he's got these six different colored hats on the table. And he's like, okay, folks. Black hat, you know?
Yep. Well, and it gives the facilitator permission. You know, it's one of the things he talked about. It gives the facilitator permission to look at somebody and go, you're doing red hat thinking right now. We're in yellow hat thinking.
Yes.
And it has not, like, you're not a terrible person. Everything's exactly. Okay. You're just in the wrong mode. Yep. You're just in the wrong mode. We need you to get into the mode everybody else is in. And I love that. Like, I love the way that would work.
Yeah. So I don't have any specific action items with it. However, going into style and rating now, I love this book. So this may be really weird to not have a single action item from this and still give it 5 stars, but I don't care. This book is great.
I don't think that's weird at all. And I don't know if you and I are either picking books that make sense for us or if we're just too easy on the rating, but I'm rating it a 5.2, right? I mean, I really, really like this book. And more importantly, I feel like I got a lot out of it that'll be applicable to my life. So I really like that.
Yeah, I don't have a specific avenue where like this is how I'm going to use this in the near future, but I have no doubt that whatever I am doing 5-10 years from now, like this is going to come back. This idea is going to stick with me. And even if I don't ever master the whole idea of the six hats thinking, I think it's something that I can easily incorporate in other places, into other meetings that can make those meetings more effective. I mean, if all this did was make meetings more effective, it's worth absolutely whatever investment you have to make in this, regardless of your working situation. I don't care if you've got like one meeting a week or you have 5 meetings every day, you're going to get value from this. And I would recommend that everybody pick this one up. I can't really think of anything negative to say about it. I guess you could say that there are some, the way that the information is presented, he obviously could go deeper into some of this stuff and he doesn't. I actually like that approach. I feel like this book could very easily have been twice as long if somebody else had written it, but I like the brevity. I feel like it's very clear. I feel like it's very concise. And it's not prescriptive. It's kind of like, this is what this does. This is how you might use it. Here's a whole bunch of examples. But the actual application, you know, you have flexibility to use it how you see fit. And I think that's the genius of it, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I was going to call out my negatives, right, and these are like super surface level. I fully admit that they're very surface level. At times I got fatigued with the number of ... examples. You know, I mean, like it was just like, okay, I got it. I got the point, but maybe other people like more of them. So that's a personal thing more than anything. And then this one is like super surface level, but it's there. at times I got confused. I know the dot, dot, dot were giving me examples, but I wanted a clearer understanding of when we were going back into his explanation versus his example. And at times I thought that his paragraphs, or they're not even paragraphs, his chunking of the text was so short at times and everything was indented. I was like, hold on, like thought. Like yeah. it wasn't like a normal book. But again, those are very, very surface level. You had called out about using this. Let's say I didn't have time to read all 170 something pages. If you just grabbed this book, or if you went on and figured out a summary of it and you just got those summary chapters, I think you could grab a decent amount of this to where you could try to implement it in a group or in a session and just see how it works. I mean, I think he's made it so accessible that I really think it's able to be, you know, understood at that level to where you can throw that into implementation relatively quickly. I mean, I do, but I agree with you. I highly recommend it's a really short read. It's a really good read that if you're interested in this at all, just pick it up and read it.
I totally agree with you. However, I will throw out a caveat there because this is kind of like the five dysfunctions of a team is sort of like this too. It's like, oh, I understand the five dysfunctions. And do you really? Because you're still stuck on level one. So you can get a cursory knowledge of what the stuff is, and you could probably start applying it in certain ways. But I've seen like the five dysfunctions of a team go off the rails. Like I've heard stories of people who have brought in like these books to their teams and been like, you're dysfunctional, here you go. That's not the way to do it. So yeah. I think you could probably get maybe a little bit of benefit from a baseline level, like a very surface level understanding of this. However, where you're really going to get exponential benefit from it is when you really get into the details.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about that's the most powerful idea is like, okay, I can grok this in one go easily, but then when I go deeper with it, I will actually extract even more value from it. Like that's good business book material right there. The other thing you're mentioning the examples, and it kind of got me thinking. I've just brought up the five dysfunctions of a team. The only thing I think that this book would be, because you could say is potentially missing, would be if someone took the six hats concept and wrote a Patrick Lencioni style fable about it. That would be kind of cool.
That's funny.
So,
well, you should do that. Why, are you saying you're going to do that? Is that an action item?
No, I've got other books I want to write before that one, but okay, back to me in a year or two, maybe. All right. Let's put six thinking hats on the shelf. What's next, Corey?
So the next book is my book, and we're going to read The Inevitable by Kevin Kelly. And we were reading a little bit faster than we normally do, so I wasn't able to start reading this one yet, but I actually was able to get the audiobook, and I started listening to it because I could do that while I was driving. And I was just like, okay, let's prime myself on reading the book. And I started listening to it. And what I'll tell you is the book was written in 2016, but so far I'm really surprised at how well it's held up. I mean, we're eight-ish years past, you know, when the book, actually it would probably be 9 years or so past when the book was written through the publication process. But what I can tell you is it's held up well. And I'm excited to read it. It's about 12 technologies and how they will impact us moving forward. And I think it's going to be a fun book to think about from a, you know, business perspective, productivity perspective, just getting better at life or living life perspective. So I'm excited to read it.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to this one. And then after that, I have a brand new book that you cannot even buy right now as we record this, but it will be out at least 9 to 10 days prior to when we would record it.
Boy, talk about cutting it close.
So hopefully that's enough time for you, but I really want to cover this one the moment that it gets out. Cal Newport is writing a new book called Slow Productivity. And I think this is the book that he was always meant to write, just based on how I hear him talking about it on his podcast. I really think this one's going to be amazing. So I'm really looking forward to going through this one and definitely want to cover it for Bookworm as soon as we possibly can. So that's what we're going to do. You can pre-order it, by the way, and there's some bonuses that you can get if you pre-order it. Apparently that's a thing now with productivity books is pre-order it and then you get like $9,000 worth of free value. I don't know how that works.
It's the new infomercial. That's what it is.
Yeah. All right. You got any Gap books?
So I'm still working on the Gap book that I've been working on, and I'm going to be working on it. It's much more of a slow read, much more of a study than it is a, you know, kind of get through it type of a book. So it's called Triumph of the Lamb. It's about the book of Revelation, and that's going to be the Gap book for now.
All right. Well, I don't have any Gap books currently. I guarantee you I will have read Gap books by the time I come back from vacation, because I'm going to bring a stack of them, and I intend to do nothing but sit by the pool and read.
Nice. How many do you think you're going to take? Like, if you're playing in a week.
Yeah, I'm thinking 6, but I don't know. I haven't packed yet, so we'll see how many fit in the suitcase.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you are reading along with us, then pick up The Inevitable by Kevin Kelly, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.